History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and invest a little bit of time. If we just ask a few questions and listen intently, it's amazing just how much we can learn. Our goal is first and foremost to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And what we find in that process is that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This is one of those rare situations in which we're continuing a conversation that began on our last episode. If you missed it, you can access that or more than 800 other episodes online at hometownheroesradio.com. What a fascinating journey Herb Ford has been on for the last 96 years, and he's not slowing down all that much. We're going to get a taste of what keeps him busy and keeps him youthful as we continue that conversation today. Herb was an only child raised by a single mother in Harlingen, Texas. He joined the Merchant Marine during World War II and headed to the Pacific aboard a fuel tanker, the SS Fort George. He's one of the last people alive who was actually there in Tokyo Bay. He was aboard the Fort George when Japan's unconditional surrender was signed aboard the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay on September 2, 1945. We heard about his time in the Army Air Corps and the years he spent at the Pentagon when it was in its infancy. He was recalled for Air Force service during the Korean War, which is when he met his wife, Anita. They enjoyed 64 and a half years of marriage before her passing 3.5 years ago. The Fords were fixtures at Pacific Union College in Angwin, California, where he retired as vice president, but his work with the college isn't over, thanks to the Pitcairn Island Study Center, which we'll learn more about today. We're also going to hear about his prolific writing and some of the books he's authored, and we're going to pick up where we left off last time. Herb shared that when he was handling public relations for the Seventh-day Adventist faith, he lined up public appearances for Medal of Honor recipient Desmond Doss, the conscientious objector turned heroic medic upon whom the movie Hacksaw Ridge was based. And Mr. Ford told us that decades ago, he was asked to write a book about Desmond Doss and his story.
Did you ever regret not writing that book?
No. I just write what I can and leave it to somebody else to do the other things.
And how many books have you written?
Well, I've written a dozen of them. Four of them have been about Pitcairn Island, different aspects of it. And the others have been stories of missionaries overseas and story of the underground leader, John Widener. Just books that have kind of been forced on me via my public relations work.
So I think if I'm reading between your words there, what I hear you saying is you never were seeking to be a prolific author. There were just opportunities and you felt that that was a calling you had to step into?
I think interest has made me an author. In other words, when I first heard the story of my book, Flee the Captor, I got a call from the head of the American Jewish Congress in Los Angeles, Haskell Azir, his name was, and he said, "We're going to honor a member of your religious faith." He said, "You may want to come bring your president of your conference to this because we're going to pay special tribute to this man while we pay tribute to other people also. But your man has done so much more for the Jewish people than these others that we're going to pay special tribute." And he said, "Leo J. Cobb, I think it is, the actor, is going to do the tribute, and you may want to come." So anyhow, we went there, and that opened up that story to my mind, and I just became so interested. And I went home, told my wife about it, and she said, "You got to write a book about him." I had only written one small little book, just a booklet, more or less, about the mission work of our church. among the Navajo Indians in Arizona. Anyhow, it kept on coming to me, you got to do it, you got to do it, from me and from my wife and others. And so we made arrangements to be with John in taping sessions over a period of 4 or 5 months, and then reducing the tapes to chapters. And it was a lot of fun. I had a great book editor at a place called the Southern Publishing Association in Nashville, Tennessee. That's an Adventist publishing house. So that first big book experience was a good one that caused me to have an interest in thinking of others. Then another missionary who had had a terrific experience in educational innovation at a Adventist school on the Yangtze River in China was another one. Choral organization from a Adventist college in Japan was the basis for another one. That one from Japan, this choral organization, had made quite a reputation for itself in Japan. Mm-hmm. And they were coming to the United States and were going to tour the States and then end their time in the United States at a general conference session of the church, which is the top world session of the church. So I was assigned to do publicity for them as they came until they left the territory that I was working in. I had quite a time arranging for one of the boats in Pearl Harbor to take this group out to the Arizona Memorial because they wanted to lay a wreath under the names there in the Arizona Memorial. And a young man from Nagasaki and a young lady from Hiroshima were going to lay this wreath there. And I had to work with the lady for a long time to try to get a boat, and the time that I needed to have the boat was coming up. And I told the lady, she was a petty officer of some kind in the Navy, I said, you know, we're not making too much progress. Is there anyone I could talk to about this matter that perhaps you work with? And so she gave me the name of a fellow, and I talked with him. He said, what do you want, Ford? I said, I want a boat. Takes this group out there and stays there while they sing a couple of songs and lay this wreath there. He said, you got it. I said, you know, I want a boat. He said, I said, you got it. So anyhow, we went out and we had a lot of media people with us out there. And I'm standing back here, and here's a television cameraman here is taking pictures as this group was, I think it was singing. Every few moments, this cameraman would shake his head. And as he did that, a little silver something would go sparkling off into the air because the sun was coming in on this. And finally I realized those were tears. That guy was crying as he was filming. And that affected me quite a bit.
You've been a part of capturing special moments and telling powerful stories. And I do want this audience in particular to hear about your book, Flee the Captor, because that's probably right up their alley. It's a book they might want to pick up. How long ago did you write that?
Oh, in the days of antiquity. 1966 was when I wrote it. And it has been republished, new editions of it, right along in English, and then in five other languages, Dutch and German and French and Czech from Czechoslovakia, and Spanish. And it's a wonderful story. John Widener was in a good position to do what he did to transport Jewish people out of France into Switzerland, which was neutral during the war. But He had many an escape from being captured, and was captured and escaped from that. And had 250 people in his underground organization. And that, of course, was a big problem, because any one of them, and one of them did, speak wrongly at the wrong time, and the Germans found out about it. And his own sister lost her life because of his service. It's quite a book.
So Flee the Captor, and I'll put a link to that at hometownheroesradio.com. Do you have, I know you're a humble man, I'm not asking you to brag, but do you have an idea of how many copies that book has sold?
Well, in terms of the huge book publishing that goes on, this is small peanuts, but the first printing went through 27,000, I think, and then there have been four printings since then, and I've not kept track of any count. Some of them have been small paperbacks, some of them big paperback, and the overseas copies, I have no idea what that is. I could imagine if it hit 100,000, I'd be surprised.
That's still a lot in the book publishing world, and you know, we've seen Schindler's List on the big screen. Corey Ten Boom, The Hiding Place is one that's very popular. You think maybe someday we'll see Flee the Captor as a Hollywood production?
Not related to me. There was a foundation created for John Widener, the hero of this book, and the people who run that foundation may try to have the story done on film. I'm not sure, but it was a great, great thing. And of course, you mentioned in Corey Ten Boom, I just never forget about her talking about sins and confessed sins, and how she talked about they're taken to the deepest place in the ocean and dropped there, and then a sign is placed there: no fishing here. That's a very powerful example of the forgiveness of sin, I think.
So you work for the church doing public relations, then you end up at Pacific Union College. You're teaching in the journalism and public relations department. You end up in administration. But somewhere along the line, this lifelong fascination with Pitcairn Island becomes more than just a hobby. How did that unfold?
Well, that's true. Of course, through the years at different times, there were contacts about and with Pitcairn Island. Some of the Pitcairners would come to the United States, and it seems like almost every time anyone would come, I would somehow be able to get to meet and talk with them. But I was at Pacific Union College, and I was reading a lot of newspapers and magazines that were telling stories about the mutiny on the Bounty and Pitcairn Island's connection with it. And they were pure Cloud 29 stuff. They would talk about wide, white, sandy beaches of Pitcairn Island, and the natives lolling on the sand under the shade of the coconut trees. And Pitcairn has none of that. Pitcairn is a volcanic outcropping from the floor of the Pacific Ocean, way down in the south, about 4,500 miles straight south of San Francisco. Straight south of San Francisco is water, because the landmass runs off to the southeast, as you may know. And that's the South Pacific Ocean down there. And anyhow, we were seeing these stories and kind of gnashing my teeth about how they were incorrect. And I began to think, shouldn't there be some place where accurate information about the Bounty and about Pitcairn Island could be stored or made and offer the information to people who wanted to tell the true story of this incident and this island. And so I began with a collection that I already had about Pitcairn and a bit of a collection that the college, Pacific Union College, had about Pitcairn. And then I had found a little classified ad in the Saturday Review of Literature about a man saying he wanted to donate his collection of Pitcairniana to a public library. And so I wrote to this man, and he wrote back and said, I see no reason why I shouldn't send my collection to you. So with those three collections, we started the Pitcairn Island Studies Center. And since that time, we have tried to add to it as much as we can. Until today, we'd have to say, in all honesty, that this Pitcairn Island Study Center at Pacific Union College in Northern California has the world's largest collection at one site of material about Mutiny on the Bounty and Pitcairn Island. And we have people coming from all over the world to study there, and people using our website to ask questions about and get information about. And we have had numerous authors write to us before their publications about the island and the mutiny and ask for authentic information. And so it's been a success in that regard. And we're happy to still have a part in it by, I work the internet and do probably 3/4 of the work of it. And the staff of the library at the college handles the on-site visits and all of the things like that.
So you're 96 years old.
Well, I'll be 97 next August.
So 5 days a week. You drive here to the office?
I have a terrific little Kona car that is all electric, and all the electricity in it comes from the solar panels on my garage. So I'm into the modern day way of living.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with Herb Ford of Exeter, California. We'll hear more about Pitcairn Island and the study center that he continues to run remotely, and we'll get some highlights from his recent honor flight to Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our continued conversation with 96-year-old Herb Ford of Exeter, California, a native of San Benito, Texas. He served in the Merchant Marine in World War II, followed by the Army Air Corps and the Air Force, and he remains extremely active today. When we left off, he told us he drives his electric car from Exeter to an office in the Evans Property Management Building in nearby Visalia, where he remotely runs the Pitcairn Island Study Center that he founded decades ago at Pacific Union College.
I don't know how many 96-year-olds you know that drive to work 5 days a week to sit here and run an international study center where people, anyone in the world that wants to know about Pitcairn Island, they basically have to come to you, right?
It may be unique or not unique, but you know, the definition of the word unique is it can't be very unique or probably unique or something somewhat unique. It's either unique or it's not. Mm-hmm. And I imagine it is unique.
I guess the big question is, why? Why do you continue to choose to spend your time and energy on this?
Because I enjoy living day to day. I have a hope for the future. That's called the blessed hope. And it's promised in the Bible to anybody who wants to find it. It keeps me singing, as it were, all along the way. But I just enjoy it. Have friends everywhere, and don't do enough for them, as I should, but I still count them good friends.
How many times have you been to Pitcairn Island?
I've only been to Pitcairn twice, but it's very difficult to get Pitcairn. Not as hard now as it used to be, but if you were to go to Pitcairn Island, you'd fly from San Francisco or Los Angeles to Tahiti, to Papeete in Tahiti, which is the capital of Tahiti. And once a week on Tuesday morning, an airplane of Air Tahiti flies out of Tahiti down south to a little island called Mangareva in the Gambier Islands. And there's a little black pearl fishing village called Rikatia, where there's a coral airstrip that this plane flies to. And there, at certain times of the year, is anchored a ship that will take you on from there to Pitcairn Island. It's about 2.5 to 3 days on the water until you get to Pitcairn. But it's a most enjoyable time to go down to this place. This little village of Rikatia, which is a pearl farming village, is so interesting because in the mornings you see all the little boats puttering out into the water to their different farms that are underwater doing these black pearls. Some of the most beautiful black pearls in the world come from this little place of Mangareva. And that's 310 miles away from Pitcairn Island. It's 1,200 miles away from Pitcairn Island to the closest hospital, so you don't want to get too sick on Pitcairn Island. No supermarkets or anything. They do have a little co-op store that the supply ship comes every 3 months, and if it's not storming off the island, then the supplies can be offloaded. If it's storming, the ship just has to go on, and it'll be another 3 months before those supplies can come to the island. They have started making Pitcairn Island as a tourist destination these days. And it, for the first time, is giving them some hope economically. And of course, one would say, well, why don't they all just move out of Pitcairn and go to some interesting place? But you know how it is about home. Do you want to leave your home? They don't want to leave their home. So that's the way that is. But they are very crafty people. They do crafts and things like that. But anything that breaks down on the island, they're very good at fixing up. They're one of about 15 British overseas territories, they're called. And of course, all the string of islands that are close to them, starting with Mangareva back up to Tahiti, are all French islands. So you have this little tiny British possession way out here in the middle of nowhere. And the only reason that Britain continues to help support Pitcairn Island is that they want to belong to a thing called the Pacific Economic Council. The rules for membership is that you have to have some inhabited dot of land in the Pacific to be a part of the council.
And I just have to ask, on a personal note, was it a thrill for you the first time you set foot on that island that you had read so much about and learned so much about?
Yes, it was. As much because I would be meeting friends that I had corresponded with for years and years, you know. Actually, the way I went to Pitcairn the first time was at a call from a man. He said, "You don't know me, but," he said, "I have got your name from the Adventist headquarters in Washington, that you know an awful lot about Pitcairn Island." And he said, "I'm with an organization called Youth with a Mission, and one of our little ships called the Pacific Ruby is going to go to Pitcairn Island soon and do good work on the island for the Pitcairners, going to paint the church and repair fishing boat motors and all kinds of things. And we've decided that if you will come with us and orient us, tell us all you know about Pitcairn Island as we travel down to the island, we'll take you down there, no cost to you." And I said, "I'll have to think on that, but I won't think very long." And so I went down and we picked up the world president, Cunningham, his name was David Cunningham. He had flown into Rickatia at that time and had a wonderful visit, all because of the good services of YWAM, as it's called.
And I guess maybe I should ask what sounds like a dumb question, but for a lot of people, they might be asking it. Why does Pitcairn Island matter? Why is it significant in your mind?
Because it was created, the people on it were created, and they have an interesting, more than just a locally interesting background. They also are part of the family, spiritual family that I'm a part of. All those things factor into why Pitcairn matters. It matters to me. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it matters to anybody else or not, really, but it does matter to me. And it seems to matter to others, too.
And I guess one last question on that, and if there's anything you want to add, feel free. Sure. But whether it's books or movies or just its significance in the culture, are there any misconceptions about Pitcairn Island or the mutiny on the Bounty that maybe you can dispel?
Well, it wouldn't be an original dispelling, I'm sure, but Captain Bligh, the captain of the ship Bounty, has been almost universally portrayed as the worst captain in the world. And the truth is that the record shows that he was not any worse than other British naval captains at the time, and indeed was softer on his sailors than many of them were. Actually, there was a Captain Edward Edwards who was sent in the ship Pandora from Great Britain down into the Pacific not long after the mutiny to find the mutineers. And Edward Edwards was a captain who would easily have allowed death to anybody that displeased him. His ship picked up about 14 of the mutineers, and then as it was going back to England, went on the Great Barrier Reef off of Australia. And as this ship was going down, these 14 people were in a cage. These 14 mutineers were in a cage built on the deck of the Pandora a la Pandora's box. And as it was going down, the other officers told the captain, we need to unlock them to let these guys out or they're going to drown. And that guy refused to give the keys until the very last moment, and the ship had canted to such a degree that water had come in, and three of those that were in there had drowned before they were released. So Bly has been misportrayed, I think, too much. And that's one thing that comes out of the story that could be different.
You never know what you're going to learn on Hometown Heroes. If you want to learn more about the Pitcairn Island Study Center, I have a link for you online, and you'll also find a link to Mr. Ford's book, Flee the Captor, and you'll see a photo from his recent honor flight to Washington, D.C., in front of the U.S. Marine Corps Memorial. What is Mr. Ford's connection to that larger-than-life statue of the raising of the flag atop Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi? Well, he's going to explain it to us when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
It's back. Keep your eyes on the sky. Here comes the Central Coast Air Fest. October 14th and 15th, bring the family to the Santa Maria Public Airport for high-flying thrills and entertainment featuring U.S. Air Force F-16 and U.S. Navy F-18 military demos, daring aerobatics performances, and vintage World War II aircraft and warbirds brought to you by Planes of Fame Air Museum. On the ground, enjoy gourmet food trucks, craft beer, and plenty of activities for the whole family. October 14th and 15th, tickets available at the gate or pre-purchase online now. Just go to CentralCoastAirFest.com. Limited number of VIP passes are available for the Honda Toyota VIP tent. Purchase online today at CentralCoastAirFest.com. The Central Coast Air Fest is made possible by Abbey Carbon and Floor. So keep your eyes on the sky. Here comes the Central Coast Air Fest. Saturday and Sunday, October 14th and 15th at the Santa Maria Public Airport. Don't miss it. Get your tickets at CentralCoastAirFest.com. Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we come down the final stretch with 96-year-old Herb Ford. And before we run out of time, I need to ask you about your most recent adventure, that trip to Washington, D.C. last month with Central Valley Honor Flight.
That experience was one of real joy. To be with veterans who had done all kinds of wonderful things during the different wars and to just have a chance to visit with them over what they did, what we did, to be again in an area where I had had such a good time previously, and to be able to be very close to some of the workings of government also, because we were allowed to go into the House of Representatives and to sit in one of the seats of one of the representatives and to listen to Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, tell us what a great guy he was. That was a real joy. and of course to be in places that we had had a slight connection with at the Iwo Jima Memorial. I had my picture taken with two other World War II veterans there, and the lowest person in that statue of raising the flag was one of my classmates in South Texas. And then over at the Vietnam Wall, the name of one man named Alan Gilmore is in one of the books I wrote called No Guns on Their Shoulders, about Adventist combat medics, frontline combat medics in Vietnam. And we did a rubbing of his name off of the Vietnam Wall. That was good to have. And the leadership, I thought, of the flight was just outstanding. You yourself were part of it, and all the others. I didn't hear one negative word from anybody of the leadership of that whole thing. And that's a record, I'll tell you.
You mentioned the Marine Corps Memorial and the giant statue of the raising of the flag atop Mount Suribachi, and you mentioned that the lowest man there was a classmate of yours. What can you tell us about him?
Well, Harlan Block was one of the flag raisers there on Iwo Jima. He died 3 weeks after the raising of the flag. He and I were schoolmates at Valley Grande Academy in Weslaco, Texas. Weslaco is right close to the Mexican border and about 15 miles from Harlingen, where I grew up. We used to play touch football in this new academy that was built, and the playing field was an unfinished field. It was just a field. And there were a tremendous lot of burrs, stickers we called them, in the field. And for whatever reason, here in high school, we would play this game in our bare feet. Both Harlan and I and the others picked up hundreds of thousands of these. But Harlan was a tough customer. When we would play football, if you ever got hit by Harlan, you were flat on the ground, I'll tell you. And a second year, attended Weslaco High School rather than this academy, and made quite a name for himself in football. As I told you, I think all young men wanted to be football greats in Texas. And at a certain time, he and all the members of his football team joined the United States Marine Corps. And they sailed, and of course, Harlan's. There was a question about Harlan, about the identity of that lower man. And for some time, it was attributed to another man. And then one of the other flag raisers, Ira Hayes, a Pima Indian from Arizona, heard that this other name was being attributed to the lower man. And he got on the highway and he hitchhiked to Weslaco, Texas, and he found Harlan Block's father, Ed Block, working in the field. And he walked up to him and he told him, "Harlan is the guy on the bottom. I know because I'm right there beside him." And so Ed Block says, "Well, sir, wouldn't you like to come and have supper with us here this evening?" And "No," he said, "I came to tell you that I'm going home." So he goes back, gets on the highway, goes back. Poor Ira Hayes, he drank himself to death. And that was too bad. In 1954, I was assigned to be a leg man to go around and help in news coverage of people in San Francisco. I was assigned to go with a short guy whose name was Joe Rosenthal. He was a staff photographer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And Joe, of course, is the man who took that picture. He was an AP photographer at that time. And as we're going around that evening, I said to him, I said, "You know, I had a friend in South Texas and a classmate who I hear was in the flag raising, but I said, I've heard other things too. Do you know who this really was? He said, what was his name? I said, his name was Harlan Block of Weslaco. Yes, he said he was. I said, but how do you know that? He said, I'm assigned to come and take pictures here tomorrow night, and I'll let you know then. And so he came the next night, and he had this little, small AP combat photographer's notebook stained and everything else. And he starts leafing through, and he stops on this page, and he says, Harlan N. Block of Weslaco, Texas. Is that your guy? I said, that's my guy. He says, here's my notes from the flag raising here. So that was determined. Rosenthal was a very interesting guy, very positive, but he had a good career as a news photographer.
So I don't think there's too many people who've gotten a chance to sit there with the guy who took the famous, maybe the most famous photo of all time, certainly the most famous military photo of all time, and have him check his reporter's notebook to confirm a fact. Did you get a feel for what that photo and that legacy meant to Joe Rosenthal?
It seemed like to me that Joe was one of the most confident fellows in the world. He seemed like he had conquered everything, and even though he had reverted down to staff photographer for the Chronicle, he just seemed to know, he just seemed happy in his suit of clothes. That was Joe. Yeah, he didn't talk much, but when he talked, he said usually pretty good stuff. I think he was very, very proud of the fact that something he had done, you know, mattered.
And you gave us a couple tastes of really how tragic that picture became for those who were captured in the photo. And your friend Harlan Block, who you'd grown up with, you mentioned was killed 3 weeks later in combat. Ira Hayes had a tragic ending. So many of them did. But for you to be there in Washington, looking at that statue.
Quite a feeling, both of nostalgia and of regret and a whole lot of things.
And what about going to the National World War II Memorial and seeing that wall of gold stars? Is there something that you contemplated or reflected on there?
Well, I didn't get the feeling from the World War II that other than it's a great and encompassing thing, and it's also got a terrific setting right beside the reflecting pool, and you look right straight down to the Lincoln Memorial. And I felt the thought put into its creation was really very great. And of course, the fact that every state would be noted there and with its people and everything like that, that was big to me, really.
You know, I asked you why Pitcairn Island matters. Do you have a thought for those of us who weren't around for World War II as to why that period of our history and what happened then still matters today?
Well, it matters because there's a comparison that can be made. One is that World War II, there was no divisiveness. Everybody was in it. Everybody was doing everything they could and committed totally to victory. And I think part of that came out of the soothing, convincing voice of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Today, there's divisiveness. We got to argue about everything. We got to find reasons why we're special and shouldn't be subject to this or that or the other thing. That's the difference, I think. And it's sad, really, because there's strength in unity and there's a lack of strength in divisiveness.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing a story that no one else could share with us. If there's anything else that you want to add, feel free. But I am curious, when you look back on 96 plus years, is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or you're most proud of?
I think I'm think I'm just very thankful that I've been allowed all the liberties that I've been allowed in life and have been able to access the hope that I have for the future of this life and a future life too. It's just been good to live, even with aches and pains here and there, but they're far, far overshadowed by the good things that were there.
And my last thing, so I asked you what, if you're looking back, I asked you what you're most thankful for, but I get the sense that you do a lot of looking ahead, and you just even indicated that in your answer. So I'm curious, is there anything you haven't done yet, a book you haven't written yet, a project you haven't completed yet, that kind of has you focused and motivated for the future?
Well, I've got parts of 4 book manuscripts right now that I'm working on. And my great hope is that I'll be given breath to finish them off. I think books communicate well for those who decide to take the time to read them. The thought of the lady who, you know, had been searching fruitlessly for her deed to her property and had finally, after 20 years, had found it in her Bible. I think that people who read books are changed a bit, hopefully for the better, by good books. Now, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Herb Ford, 96 years young, and we're going to keep an eye out for more good books to come from this prolific author. Again, you can link to more about his books, that Pitcairn Island Study Center he founded, and photos from his recent honor flight to Washington, D.C. at hometownheroesradio.com, or pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.